Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 1, Text 28, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace. No. Oh, it's Chapter 2. By His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Kachid Varuta Adhipatihi Yadunam Pradyumnaha Aste Sukham Anga Viraha Yam Rukmini Bhagavataha Abhilebhe Aradhya Vipran Smaram Adi Sarge Kachit Varuta Dipatir Yadunam Pradyumna Aste Sukamanga Viraha Yang Rukmini Bhagavato Bhilebhe Aradhya Vipran Smaramadi Sarge Kachit Varuta Dipatir Yadunam Pradyumna Aste Sukamanga Viraha Yang Rukmini Bhagavato Bhilebhe Aradhya Vipran Smaram Adi Sarge Ladies,
Bhagavato Arāja Vibhraṁ Saramādhi Sakye Kachitvarutājipadīryadūnām Pradyumnāste sukhamangavīraha Yam rūpini bhagavato bhirebhe Arādhya vipraṁ saramādhi sasve
Kachit weather Varuta of the military Adhipatihi commander in chief Yadunam of the Yadus Pradyumnaha the son of Krishna named Pradyumna Aste is Sukham happy Anga O Uddhava Viraha the great warrior Yam whom Rukmini the wife of Krishna named Rukmini Bhagavataha from the personality of Godhead Abhilebhe got as a prize Aradhya pleasing Vipran Brahmanas Smaram Cupid Kamadeva Adi Sarage in his previous life. O Uddhava, please tell me how is Pradyumna, the commander-in-chief of the Yadus, who was Cupid in a former life? Rukmini bore him as her son from Lord Krishna by the grace of Brahmanas, whom she pleased. Purport, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, Smara, Cupid or Kamadev is one of the eternal associates of Lord Krishna. Jiva Goswami has explained this very elaborately in his treatise, Krishna Sandarbha. Om Gyanatimi Rand Hasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Nama Shrishtam Manumapi Shachiputram Atraswarupam Rupam Tasya Grajam Urupuring Maturim Goshtavartim Radha Kundam Girivaramaho Radhika Madhavasham Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Sri Gurum Tamnatosmi Vandeham Sri Guru Shriyatav Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavanscha Shri Rupam Sagraja Tam Sahagana Raghuna Tanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakanvitam Guru Vaishnav Bhagavan Tina Smarani Hoi Bigna Binashan Anayashi Hoi Nijavan Chita Puran Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Discussion of the personality of Godhead includes discussion of his associates, devotees, energies. Here is discussed Pradyumna and also Yadunam, the fact that he was a leading warrior of the Yadus, brings to mind all the Yadus. Anga is also mentioned, Uddhava. Rukmini is mentioned. Rukmini is, of course, the first wife of Krishna. He had many others. She was the first wife, and it's not unexpected when Krishna got more wives. He put a cap on it after 16,108. We don't hear. about any more after that. Otherwise, he could have gone on expanding unlimitedly. Srila Prabhupada sometimes said to his female disciples who were having difficulties in their family life or not getting a husband, then you make Krishna as your husband. Sometimes he told them that you can make Krishna as your son. And there's many women in India today, even they may have their own sons, but they like to think of Krishna as their son, and they have the baby Krishna deity. Just recently I was with a devotee in India. He recently married, has a young daughter, one child. And his mother said to me that next time we want to have a little Gopal, means they want to have a son, but they said specifically in that language. She got the child from Krishna, Abhilebe, Bhagavato Abhilebe. This is the understanding, different to the modern Western understanding, that the woman, the mother, the child is more intimately connected, but it's considered that the child is produced from the man in the field. The seed is given and it's put in the field of the wife's womb, and therefore the wife or who wants to get child, wants to get a son, feels that she is being given the child by the husband. She bore him, Rukmini bore him, Pradyumna, as her son from Lord Krishna, by the grace of brahmanas whom she pleased, specifically Durvasa Muni, Vipran here in the plural. And not only Durvasa did she please, or maybe even if we say specifically Durvasa, the plural is given in respect. That's narrated in Mahabharata, how Krishna and Rukmini took up austerities in order to get a son. And then they had to please Durvasa, who is a hard taskmaster. In the modern age, he'd be put in prison for abuse. And actually, the story is not very nice to hear, but it is there in the Mahabharata, how he had Krishna and Rukmini pull him on a chariot. They became the horses in the great heat. So it's not very pleasant to hear. But he wanted, in many cases, we find Durvasa Muni takes to the limit or beyond the limit of how much people are prepared to please the brahmanas, because Krishna himself, we find here in Bhagavatam and elsewhere, he says to always please the brahmanas and not disrespect them, even if they behave badly toward you. So she got the son Rukmini, and everyone was very happy. In the whole kingdom, everyone was very happy. They become very anxious in the kingdom. If the king, until there's an heir to the throne, and it is, as Srila Prabhupada used that word, the law of primogeniture. And you all know what that means, right? I guess Prabhupada learned that word at school. It's not a common English term, but it means that the inheritance, or specifically for in the royal families, the heir to the throne is a male. Srila Prabhupada discussed this in a talk in London, that in your country it's a queen, but in the Vedic system, the queen is the wife of the king, not that she herself is the ruler of the state. Sometimes that is noted. In India, the example is given of Rani Jhansi, who, after, this was during the British time, the Queen of Jhansi, which is a town in North India, at that time a state. So when her husband was actually resisting the British, and he was very capably doing so, and so by conspiracy, he was killed. One of his own men ratted on him and gave the British the way to kill him or whatever. And then the Queen, she took up the fighting herself. And that's very famous, I believe, in Jhansi. I did go there, but I don't remember. It was a long time ago. There's a statue of her on her horse, and she had a baby strapped to the back also. So she was quite successful in fighting the British. And I don't remember exactly the history, but she was betrayed by one of her ministers, and therefore she was able to be killed. And the idea was that the British had, when I say the British, it means one commander. He's there, and he didn't have satellite phones and all those things, so he had to call the shots himself. He had to make decisions on the battlefield himself. So it was a deal made that I'll betray the Queen, and then you make me the king under the British. There were many in India at the time of independence in 1947. There were many kings still, but they were all under the British. They're superficially independent, but in their court they had an advisor from the British throne, which means they had to do what he said. So anyway, they were killed, and the British took over. They took control. They wanted to control the whole of the subcontinent. And then the rascal who ratted on the Queen of Jhansi. Ratted, you all have that word. It's British slang, American, it's also that. The military commander said, well, if you did that to your own queen, we can't trust you either. So he killed him also. All's fair in love and war. It's politics. So anyway, I'm just giving that as an example of how it's sometimes noted how in Indian history there were very prominent women who took a leading role, although that's in Kali Yuga. That's not, previously that wasn't there. We don't find any queens taking charge. So yeah, she was the queen, and everyone was very happy when she got her son, because it has to be a son who is the heir to the throne. But yeah, she was happy, and the whole kingdom was happy, because they couldn't imagine how can you have a country running on without a king? You have to have a king. They can't imagine in the modern scenario that there's people are elected with no character, no training, and no character. No idea of dharma, never even heard the word dharma. This is Kali Yuga, how such people can be in charge. Even when the independence came of India, political independence from Britain in 1947, many of the erstwhile kings, they thought, well, naturally we'll be in charge because we're the Kshatriyas, and that's where it's supposed to, and they were surprise, how can they, what's this democracy? Because the British had made it a condition of so-called independence, that they have democracy, and that's not the traditional system. I guess they thought it's easier to control if there's democracy. That's maybe why there's so much. Anyway, that's getting into something else. That's another level of politics. Is you'll find the Western press is constantly against the present government of India. They don't want a strong government. They prefer to have all these weak people, these small parties who bicker among themselves. They prefer that India doesn't have a strong government, so they always give bad press to the present dispensation. And in general, the Western press and academia is always undermining India and Indian culture. Maybe they'll say something nice about some of the food or something like that, but they don't like the culture at all. So everyone, the kings, then they thought, then naturally we'll become the rulers. And democracy, I thought, what is this? They put a brahmana, the first prime minister was from brahmana background. They're not supposed to be kings, the leaders. How can they rule? And the big leaders in the original first government of India were then, I don't think any of them were Kshatriyas by background. The Nehru was there, superficially a brahmana. Patel was there, Vaishya. So the people wanted a son so that they can have, there can be continuity. Otherwise it's a very dangerous position. If there's no king, then there's no one to protect the citizens. We see that when Vena Maharaj, he was killed by the brahmanas because he was such a wicked person. But then immediately the thieves and rogues and rascals took advantage. So the brahmanas solved one problem, but then another problem arose. At least under Vena, even though he was so evil in many ways, at least there was no crime, hardly at all. We find that generally in despotic regimes. Just like in the Soviet Union, a despotic regime, but there was hardly any crime. First of all, there wasn't much to steal anyway, and so there wasn't much theft. A very strict control on people, and you can just be searched. I was in Moscow in 1986, I think it was, shot maybe a year or two before the whole thing started to fall apart. Heavy communist rule, just walking down the street, and all of a sudden some plainclothes cops come up and they just want to see show your identity, document. You could understand what they wanted. Just you can be checked any time, and if it's in very strict control, you're not even allowed to move from one city to another without permission, not even to visit. You have to, trains were running, but you have to have permission to go from one place to another, just to even to visit some relatives. So strict, but there's very little crime, and there was very little to steal. Some murders, this, that, and the other, but. Freedom, America is the land of the free, right? Isn't that right? We all heard America is the land of the free. Statue of Liberty is there. But the more freedom you give, then the more crime there is, because people take advantage. So there's an inverse relationship between freedom and security. So the people, they welcome a strong government who can, a strong king who can keep things in order. And those who are obedient citizens, now that's not a very popular term, probably, in much of the Western world, but Srila Prabhupada uses this term often. Those who are obedient citizens, they have nothing to fear from the government. theoretically, talking in an ideal situation. And they welcome the police. They want to see the police going around. It used to be they'd walk around. I think they don't. Yeah, they still walk around. You still get them in the same walking also. And the law-abiding people, they welcome that because they think that's our security. Otherwise, if they're not there, then we're not safe. So the citizens became very happy when Pradyumna was born. But as fate would have it, he disappeared shortly after birth. The demon Shambhara had heard, you've all read this, I presume, in Krishna book. The demon Shambhara had heard that this boy would kill him. He would grow up and kill him. So he threw him into the deep ocean and left him for dead. So there you get a lesson from that. If you're ever going to kill someone, do it properly. Same thing with Jarasandha and Krishna and Balaram. He lit the fire all around the hill and just presumed they're burned to death. But he didn't actually see the dead bodies. So same thing with Shambhara. If you throw an infant into the middle of the sea, that's it, finished. No chance of survival. But as it happened, everything is orchestrated by Krishna's yoga maya potency. That child was swallowed by a big fish and didn't die in the fish's belly. The fish was caught by fishermen who operated out of the port of the state overseen by Shambhara. And as it was a big fish, something very special and wonderful, they had the idea, which good citizens do, that the best of everything should be offered to the king. We would think that the best of everything should be offered to the deity, but the best of everything should be offered to the king. Krishna said the same thing to Shatrajit regarding the Syamantaka jewel. You should give it to King Ugrasena. The best, it's such a wonderful thing. Why should you as a citizen have something better than anything the king owns? So that idea is there. So they gave that big fish to the king, who sent it to the kitchen for dressing, preparing for eating. And in the course of cutting up the fish, a little child was born. And that was Pradyumna. He grew up very quickly and fought with Shambhara. This story is given in some detail in Harivamsa Purana. Shambhara was an expert at mystic military artifices, and Pradyumna's wife, who happened to be in the kitchen, she was also Mayavati. She was also, the very name, she was very expert in mystic powers, so she helped Pradyumna, who killed Shambhara, and then they flew over by her mystic power. Of course, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. They flew to Dwaraka, and Pradyumna sat himself down in the inner quarters where the queens live, where no man can come except the husband of the queens. And the women there thought it was Krishna because he looked so much like Krishna. But then they noticed it's a little bit different. And Rukmini thought, if my son had remained, if he had survived, I think he would have grown up to be something like that. And then it all became clear. So Pradyumna is the first son. Most beautiful, looks very much like Krishna. And he is Cupid, Kamadev. Krishna is the transcendental Cupid, Aprakrita Madan. He is worshipped by the Kama Gayatri. Those who chant the Gayatri mantras know that we chant the Kama Gayatri. We offer invocation to Kama Deva with his Pushpabana, his flower arrows. So that Krishna is the transcendental Cupid. And he has his flower arrows, which are much more dangerous than arrows made of steel. Dangerous in a different way. But they are meant for piercing the hearts of the gopis. You shouldn't shoot arrows at women. But Cupid, he shoots them both ways. Krishna himself is said to be under the influence of Kamadeva. This in his dealings with the gopis and with his queens, more so with the gopis. But at the same time, he is the transcendental Cupid. It's a highly esoteric subject. Where does desire come from? Kama means desire or lust. Sometimes it's translated as desire and sometimes as lust. Lust means desire, but with a strong intensity and specifically sexual desire. Where does that come from? The materialists or philosophical materialists say that there's only matter. Everything comes from combination of chemicals. That's how we're all here today. My question to them is, where does desire come from? They say that the chemical or biological evolution has come about by different chemicals interacting and then somehow they come alive, what we call alive, and they have consciousness, which is of course just a byproduct of chemical interaction. And then the various species come about and they're in a struggle for survival and they want to perpetuate the species and each living being is trying to stay alive and to perpetuate the species. Why? Why do chemicals have such a disposition? Where does desire come from in any chemicals? The answer is, it's not coming from the chemicals. Desire is a symptom of the soul, which comes ultimately from Krishna. The impersonalists, they want to stop all desires. The yogis, they want to stop the somersaults of the mind. Yoga, Chitta Vritti Nirodha, the definition of yoga given by Patanjali, is stopping the inclination of the consciousness, which is generally taken by those who are in the line of Patanjali to mean stopping all thoughts altogether. But a Vaishnava understanding of this would be that to stop the materialistic thoughts. Mukti hitvanyata rupam swarupena vyavastiti hi. Liberation, in the full and complete sense, means to give up this false form with its concomitant false desires and to accept one's real form. Now, desire is life. No life without desire. And desire leads to problems if it's not Krishna conscious, if it's not centered toward Krishna. Desire centered on Krishna is very relishable. That is the whole message of the Bhagavatam from the very beginning. We are enjoined from the very beginning. Pibata Bhagavata Rasa Maalayam. Go on drinking this nectar of the rasa of Bhagavatam. What is this rasa, the bhakti rasa? It's all hearing about Krishna and his avatars and his expansions and his activities and his devotees. It's all revolving around desire. Krishna has his desire. And everyone, every other living is trying to fulfill Krishna's desire. And Pradyumna, who is non-different from Krishna, is the very personification of Krishna's desire. He's described as a very obedient son. He's always thinking how to please his father. So we should follow in the footsteps of Pradyumna and be very obedient and channel our desires toward Krishna. Krishnarte akila cheshta. All activities should be simply for Krishna's sake. All the devotees, there are so many devotees described here in Bhagavatam. Their names are given, in some cases only the name is given and nothing else. Because if you describe every devotee in all detail, then Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda, there are unlimited Vaishnavas. So it's not possible to even know all their names, what to speak of all their activities. But Krishna knows them all. And every one of them, the life of everyone is governed by the principle. Krishnarte Akila Cheshta. Everything is done simply for Krishna's sake, for pleasing Krishna. Hare Krishna. I'll finish there. Unless anyone has anything they'd like to say.
Maharaj, in the Krishna book, Prabhupada writes that Pradyumna, the incarnation of Cupid, would have to be in the Jiva Tattva category. But in the first canto, and
that's a commonly asked question. Srila Prabhupada says in the Jiva Tattva category. Although clearly elsewhere, it's established that he's Pradyumna of the Chaturvyuha. This Vasudev Sankarshan Pradyumna. And Aniruddha. There is an answer to that. I think Gopi Prandana Prabhu gave it, but I don't remember what it is. I'll have to look it up. Maybe he's appearing as a jiva, acting as a jiva, something like that. I'm not sure. Sorry.
I had another question in regards to...
Okay, remind me. Send it. You're in that BVK Sangha? Okay, join it and ask the question there.
Oh, on the email forum?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'm in that one.
Yeah, send the question there.
Okay. And another question that I have for you is in regards to Rukmini Devi and Krishna's other principal queens. Usually we see that Krishna, Dwarkanath Krishna is worshipped with Rukmini and Satyabhama, but Jambavati is
the second wife. She's number two in
order. So why
order.
Is she disregarded?
Well, Satyabhama, by her very personality, is prominent. She makes sure she's prominent. She's not going to sit back and not be prominent. That's her pride, her transcendental pride. Rupa Goswami gives us the understanding that Satyabhama is Radha and Rukmini is Chandravali. So although Rukmini is very well behaved and she never annoys Krishna, and Satyabhama is always annoying Krishna, and she's never well behaved. She is, but in a very different role. So that would be called Satyabhama is Vama Swabhav. That's her is psychological analysis. She's the nature, contrary nature, left wing. And Rukmini is Dakshin Swabhava, like Chandravali. She's not contrary, she's compliant. This is all discussed in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and Nectar of Devotion, and more so in this Ujjvala Nilamani, which I haven't read, only bits and pieces here and there. And then Satyabhama, that her nature is there with Jagadananda Pandit, and Gadadha Pandit is like Rukmini, although he is Radha also. These are all very complex, difficult to understand, all these matters.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. I was given that Cupid was burned up by Lord Shiva.
Yeah, well that's why, yeah, that's stated, isn't it? That Cupid lost his body because he was burned by Lord Shiva. He then became known as Ananga, we also say in the Karma Gayatri. We invoke the name of Ananga. That name remains with him. He has no body. That means he can go everywhere. He's not limited to a body. He can go anywhere and everywhere. Calm is everywhere. Lust is everywhere. He's in everybody. But he got a body again coming as Pradyumna.
And in Pradyumna, when he came in Pradyumna, it was given that there was two personality that was there. How is that possible, especially with...
What's that, two personalities?
Yeah, it was like Cupid was separate, from my understanding, was like Cupid was separate from Pradyumna, from this...
It may be. Such things are mentioned. Sometimes people are said to be the avatar, or just like Haridas Thakur is said to be avatar both of Brahma and Prahlad. How does it work? I don't know. Krishna knows. He orchestrates it all.
Guru Maharaj, you mentioned about the Western press and the Western academia doesn't like Indian culture, you said?
That's a general unspoken policy.
Could you elaborate on that?
Another unspoken policy is to not criticize China too much in the academia, because they get so much money from China, directly or indirectly. There's so much in the Western press against how in the present situation in India, so much against Muslims. You don't hear any more about how the... Whoops. Wait a minute. Be careful what you say. That's it. People are afraid to say. They'll get their tenures as professors stopped, or the money will stop flowing in to the university. If you mention about the what used to be called atrocities but are not spoken of anymore of Muslims in China, we don't hear about it anymore. Yeah, the educational system in America, like pretty much everything else, is run as a business. Even the printing of money is a business, right? It's not in the hands of the government. So everything's run as a business, so the universities have to get money, which means they're purchasable. If you have enough money, you can tweak the whole educational system and make propaganda and teach according to what certain powerful people want the narrative to be. I guess that's called a conspiracy theory. But it's pretty plain. It's pretty plain to show that universities in America, major universities, get major funding from Chinese agents. A year or two ago, I was speaking to a devotee who's a university professor. He's teaching Jainism somewhere out on the West Coast. I asked him, why are you teaching Jainism? Why don't you teach about Vaishnavism? And he said, the Jains give money. They want these things taught. There are books written on this, actually. How the education system, it's bought off. You don't know that? You know? No. I just thought it was common knowledge. How all this wokeism came about, it was a deliberate policy to change the mindset of the people of America.
Sorry, what was the example? What was it that was to change the mindset of the people in America?
Change the mindset of the people in America, yeah.
What did they do to do that? I missed the word there somehow.
But wokeism.
What is that?
He doesn't even know what wokeism is. We're surrounded by it everywhere, all over the place. Wokeism is a derogatory term which is applied to those who consider... It's now... Well, it depends, I guess, which side of the fence you're on. We're talking about... What are we talking about? Contemporary social trends now, and nothing really to do with Krishna consciousness, but it's a major factor in the consciousness of the world today, especially in America, more than anywhere. And we're supposed to be dealing with the consciousness of people, and we're preaching to people. So woke, the idea is you're awake. If you're awake, you're woke. And woke means to understand, for instance, that the whole history of, it's only one factor, the whole history of the human race is one of men oppressing women. And we have to push back against that. The whole history of the white people is one of oppression of everyone else, especially blacks. The whole history of human society is one of heterosexuals suppressing homosexuality, and so on and so on and so on. There's a whole big history. About 100 years ago in Frankfurt, there was a group of academics. Well, they were based in Frankfurt. After the Second World War, maybe even before, they came to the United States and entered the educational system. And they dreamed up neo-Marxism. Marxism is based on the idea that the capitalists, by having capital, they oppress the proletariat. But neo-Marxism is the idea that in any way that you oppress, it's not just economic oppression, but there's oppression at all in all areas and all fields. So whoever is oppressed, you have to, You have to pull down the oppressors and bring up the oppressed. So that's basically what wokeism is, that we have to push up or just everything, tear everything down. That was actually the aim of this Frankfurt school. We have to tear down the whole society. And what will come in its place? That there's no saying. It's atheistic. It's demoniac. There's no affirmative action is all part of that also. Affirmative action? You know what that is?
Not really. I've heard the phrase, but I couldn't give you a definition.
It means that you have to put in position. You have to make steps by using the governmental apparatus to put oppressed people in position. For instance, we see that traditionally blacks, women, homosexuals have been oppressed. So you have to, in the schools, you have to give a quota for them so that they can come up and take power, which means that that's another reason why the educational system in America is going down. It's not a meritocracy so much as a affirmativeocracy. and the people who could actually develop the country in a material way, develop the society, they're kept down because within their race or whatever, just like we see people of Asian origin, particularly Indian, Chinese, Korean, Japanese in America, they have the culture to push their children to work hard and succeed academically, which other people, they don't have that culture. So there's a disproportionate number of people from Asian backgrounds who are going way ahead in academics, and they want to stop that, because why should one race go ahead? We don't see affirmative action to put Asians into jazz bands, for instance. Every social group has their fortes and weaknesses. So wokeism is the idea that we have to pull down the society, those who are oppressing. But they don't see that there will always be a hierarchy. That was a failure of classical communism. They say we want to make rule of the people, but it doesn't work like that. There has to be someone in charge. If you just drag someone off the street and say, okay, now you be head of the American Armed Forces, it'd be a military disaster. You have to have someone who's qualified. And it's not just anyone. And it's not just anyone who has even the inclination to be trained like that, or the ability to be trained like that. So it goes against the natural order that different people have different abilities, and there will always be higher and lower in society. The Vedic Varnashram system recognizes that according to our karma, we all have different abilities, strong points, weak points, and puts us in the position which is suitable for us, for our own psychophysical nature, for ourselves to be satisfied and to contribute in the best way to society. And a perverted reflection of that is the demoniac society, which is not Varnashram and not based on God consciousness, which is what Marxism seeks to pull down. But without proper knowledge of the plan of God, it simply causes disaster. And the history of civilizations, they rise and they fall. So the Western civilization is now in its, has clearly the signs of a dying civilization. One of the signs of a dying civilization is that people bring in people who are of not hardworking and principled and just let them take over the country. And then they make facilities for sense gratification, but then they just, because of their sense gratification, they lose their mental and moral strength. And then they let in all people to do all the dirty work, and then they don't have children, because having children is too much nuisance when you just want to enjoy yourself. And it's complex, but this is what's going on now, and bring in all kinds of people who are not so capable and not going to work hard and just want to enjoy the facilities which you created. Again, I'm speaking very simplistically, and I haven't actually studied this in great depth, but it's not that difficult to understand. There was a British, he was a layman, he was actually in the military in the Middle East somewhere, and he studied this, and after he came back from his military service, around the 1940s, he wrote a short book about, I can't remember the title, his name is Unwin, The Fall of Civilization, something like, very short, but it's only about 50 pages. And the summary of it is that bad times make strong men. Right? That's easy to understand. When things are tough, then you have to be tough to deal with it. Strong men make good times. Right? By working hard and dedication, and you make the situation better. Then good times make weak men. When you have a situation to enjoy, then you just enjoy, and then you lose your principles of hard work and dedication. Think of the Roman Empire and their feasts and eating, regurgitating, and all this kind of thing. And then weak men make bad times, and that's the cycle. So it's clearly seen that Western civilization is in its dying phase. It'll take time; won't happen overnight. It took centuries for the Roman Empire to eventually be totally destroyed. But it was weak for centuries. Question: how do Kshatriyas keep the interest of wealthy Vaishyas at bay? It's a Varnashram question. The Kshatriyas control society. Vaishyas, their wealth is based on land. That's the basis of Vaishya wealth. And the land is given by the Kshatriyas. So they can't just multiply unlimitedly. And also in an economy which runs on real money, gold, and real goods, you can't artificially expand the economy as is going on in the present time, with all kinds of manipulations by economic systems literally destroying the fabric of most of the world by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. You can do all. The United States has a fiscal debt of trillions of dollars, right? And how come they're able to go on giving billions of dollars in aid? It's all by manipulation, the manipulation of the system. It's all very complex. They're able to do it, but if there's nothing there, eventually it's just all going to collapse. That's also predicted, because the US dollar is the basis of the world economic system, and that's going to get undermined if and when, well, it's already started with nations doing transactions not using the dollar, but that may be seriously undermined if the BRICS countries bring in their own currency. Because previously, the gold, just like we have, what's the British currency? The pound. Why is it called a pound? It used to be you'd get a promissory note, a piece of paper. This paper means one, you actually have 1 pound of gold, 1 pound, which is, oh, you use pounds in this country also, right? Still you use that? Yeah. Ounces and pounds. Yeah. So it was like that. And so you have a piece of paper, and you theoretically you should be able to go anytime and pick up your 1 pound of gold. But eventually it became such that the governments actually began with bankers. They started, because people didn't come to get their gold, so they started issuing paper in excess of the number of pounds. If you only have a reserve of, say, 1,000 pounds of gold, you shouldn't be able to give out promissory notes, papers, more than 1,000. But then they see that, well, no one's coming to get, let's give more. We'll give out more than actually exist. And then people, as loans, and then people have to pay us, and we get rich on paper. So it all turned into paper currency. And that's how all the banking system started, and it's all mirrors and smoke. Yeah. So what was the question, actually? How do you keep the interest? You can't tinker with the system if the system is based on real goods and real currency.
I can't explain exactly how this is related, but I'm sure it's related. Over the last year or two, I'm hearing the same story from people I meet on the street all the time. Because I, you know, trying to get donations, they don't have cash. And I say, well, wow, what's going on? How come nobody has any cash? Why is that? And they say, oh, because it's so much more convenient to use a card and it's safer. You know, you can't get robbed. Meantime, but like up until like, say, 5 years ago, for my entire lifetime, and I don't know how long before that, people safely carried cash. And those, it's propaganda. Somebody, a narrative is going out to the people, because everybody's saying the same thing. Wherever you go in the country, everybody's saying...
If we discuss these things, it'll come under the category of conspiracy theories.
Okay.
Something is going on which we don't know the whole narrative.
But they're definitely... I don't know who and why, but they're trying to move people away from using...
Right, get people... Modi in India is promoting cashless society. One thing is that then the government can keep tabs on every transaction, which means that the massive corruption... It's already reduced a lot in India, actually. There was the number one economy and the number two economy, and the number two was probably bigger. Well, actually, there's three. There's one which goes through the banking system, which is at least semi-bona fide. And then there's cash, which is not in the banking system, which and a huge number of people, even today in India, don't pay taxes because they don't earn enough, and they may be just selling some bananas on the side of the street, or they may just have a little land and they have some cows and this and that. So they don't come within the... So that's part of the economy. It's just like you said in... anyway, it's getting too much to discuss. But another thing is the number two economy, black money, in which is probably at least as big as the valid or seen economy, in which people have huge amounts of money not declared, and there's attempts to control how much people own. There are land ceilings, you can only own so much. So a whole system came up in which people kept land and properties in other people's name, and those people are very weak compared to them, so they can't just... So practically one person owns it, but legally it's in someone else's name. So much corruption, and already a lot of it's been cut down by the Indian government's policies. And it becomes more difficult with computerization. And they want to make a cashless society, completely cashless society, so that you can't do all this, these corrupt dealings. Everything will be seen, everything will be seen, at least by the government, maybe not by everyone else. And there are so many things, Swiss bank accounts. We heard that all the Swiss bank accounts, they're going to be revealed, still not revealed. Offshore banking. Why is that, offshore banking? You know about that? You're nodding your head. You have a lot of money. You people with lots of money, they often stash it away so the tax man can't get it. You can put it in the Cayman Islands or the Virgin Islands or somewhere where... The history of Kali Yuga is one of governments trying to one angle on it is a history of governments trying to exploit the people and people trying to get around the governments. From what I understand, the whole idea of government in America in the beginning of the founding fathers is very, the ideals are very different to what it's developed to be. They wanted to have government with as little government as possible. That's the meaning of the land of the free, right? Because they don't want to be oppressed by governments. People came from Europe being oppressed by governments, and they wanted to have as government, as little government as possible. But then society is so much more complex. We're getting into big, big discussions here, and I'm ahead of you all in knowing some things about all these things, but then how much do I know? I don't spend all my time researching all these things. What's the solution? Distribute those books. One of my godbrothers, Sannyasi, last year, when you're getting older, last year seems like yesterday. I also mentioned the term to him, woke, and he didn't know what it is. He didn't know what it was. So I explained a little bit, and the next day he mentioned it in the class he gave. I think he must have looked it up a bit. I feel we should know it. If we're preaching, we should know about it. I mean, it's a major social current. Definitely the Republicans are talking about it, pushing back on wokeism. What it manifests, I mean, the ideas are laudable, that we want to stop oppression and this and that, but then what happens is those who want to stop the oppression, they become oppressors, as we saw in the communist regimes in the 20th century. But these are the people who are going to be running the country, if there's any country left, in just like the hippies generation, they became, now they're also dying out. We are dying out. So it'll come into their policies later on, if America stays together as one country. We don't know. Don't know what's going to happen. The social fabric is disintegrating. The fabric on which democracy is built is disintegrating. That means trust of government. It's disintegrating. So we don't know. exciting times. How do we respond to the exciting times? One thing is to push back by preaching and distributing books. Another way is just make our own communities as best we can. That's also a major difficulty we're facing in establishing communities. We can't do things, everything we want to do, according to the way we want to do it, what we've learned from Srila Prabhupada, because the laws of the land won't let us. Years ago, I was at one Gita Nagari, I think it was, some farm, and some devotee showed me his, oh, we just built a simple house. I just come from India. It looked like a palace to me. So I think it was Prabhupada village. I'm getting mixed up. Anecdotes get mixed up in the mind. So I said, well, why didn't you put the toilet outside? That's if you're going to have a toilet at all, it's better to have it outside, outhouse, right? That's an old word for toilet. So the government won't allow you. If you're going to build a building, you have to, if you're going to build a house, a residential house, you have to have the toilet inside the building. So like that, it's a small thing. We're all used to having toilets inside the building, but it's actually, even just like that word outhouse, we can understand that it wasn't considered very proper previously. Maybe before they had all these flush toilets, you want to put it outside so it didn't smell so bad.
You have to buy your seeds from Monsanto. You can't buy, you know.
You have to buy seeds from Monsanto?
There's some sort of, you can't just, you know, get organic.
Well, that's another. I mean, if you start to talk about it, we could be here for all day. Yeah. Monsanto, someone's growing organic food and some Monsanto seeds, there's cross-pollination, and then the small organic farmer gets sued by Monsanto. Demoniac. And then someone sued Monsanto for cross-pollinating my organic stuff. But maybe it was 2 years ago, there were massive protests against Monsanto all over the Western world. You hear about that? No. Didn't come in the press. Wasn't reported, because it's all one cabal. They call it the deep state. That's a conspiracy theory. There's a deep state. Anything which goes against what they want to tell you is the fact is a conspiracy theory. I don't believe all conspiracy theories. I have my doubts about lizards invading and... What's that? Are you two lizards or what? You're shaking his arm to show, yeah, we got away with it. Although one god sister said to me last year, well, it is possible, right? Because Arjuna married Ulupi, who's from the snake kingdom, the Naga kingdom. And yeah, it's possible. It's possible, but because something's possible doesn't mean it's actually happening. Okay, Hare Krishna. This is very interesting topics, no doubt, but Hare Krishna.
Can you take one more question from Alex?
Yeah.
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. Guru Maharaj, I was wondering how Srila Prabhupada said that if we were to take the means of exchange of currency just in the form of gold and other stuff like that, things like prostitution and all that would reduce. And could you explain how that would be the case, how the thing would reduce by just, you know, using gold and silver as the means of exchange?
One thing is, without this liquid currency and which allows transactions, international transactions instantly, that's also quite recent. It used to be If you get money sent from one country to another, you still have to wait a few days. Say if I send money from America to India, that's because the banks hold it. Whatever money they have, they hold it. They don't give it immediately. And if you have a lot of money floating around, then you have money in your hands for some extra time, and they don't give you the interest. Yeah, this whole artificial civilization couldn't have developed if it wasn't for artificial money. How will gold stop prostitution? Srila Prabhupada, his idea is that by that this fiat money, it's called fiat money, this artificial currency, it creates dishonesty. It's based on dishonesty, and it creates dishonesty, and it breeds all bad qualities in people. So prostitution, totally prostitution, is never going to be stopped. That's called the world's oldest profession, right? Although probably farming came before. Or anyway, they're going on since time immemorial. But the tendency toward vice would be much curtailed by having an economic system not based on cheating. They're not to say that cheating can't take place, but the very basis of the whole society is cheating. And then, to expand the economy, you have to have constant, it always has to be growth, which means there's always inflation. So whatever money you have, tomorrow it's worth less. Whatever wages you have, if you're earning, say, what's the average wage here? How much people earn? $5,000 a month or something? What is it? I have no idea. I'm just guessing here. $5,000 a month is a proletariat income, is it? So if you have a job of $5,000 a month, then what you can buy with $5,000 in a year from now is going to be less than what you can buy now, because inflation is always eating away the value of your income, and it's institutionalized cheating. So so vice won't be totally stopped by having gold as the basis of the currency, but the very tendency toward cheating is invisibly promulgated by a cheating financial system. That's what I can understand. Prostitution totally stopped? Unlikely. Is there in Dwarka, right? Although, I'm getting to another topic. There's prostitution and there were courtesans also, which both in Europe and India and everywhere, not exactly the same thing. So the words, Srila Prabhupada often used the words prostitute. Well, sometimes he explained once that what you call girlfriend, we call prostitute. The idea that a girl can be linked up without marriage to a male, unmarried, that's also called prostitution. And rape also. In Indian English, rape means, it can mean even consensual sex outside marriage. Hare Krishna. We're sitting here talking and I'm holding you all up. I also have things to do. So, Hare Krishna. Trying to make it seem as if I'm thinking of your interest. Vanja kalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhu evacha patitanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah. Dante nidaya charnakam padiyo nipakta kritva chakakushatamedadam prahi sadhava.